To I Mama Kenya. Echo.
Thank you to my great colleagues, Anne Michaela and Jackie McMillan, with whom I've worked for years. And part of what we're up to is we remember that if we look up the word to dream in a good dictionary, the word to dream comes from an old English word, dreamon, which meant to dream, and it also meant to make music. So it lets us know that making music is a way of participating in dreaming the world into being. And the reason also we draw from the Orisha traditions of Santeria, originating in Nigeria, coming down into the Caribbean, Brazil, and then up through into this country where it's blooming in America, is that these are traditions of musical invocation. You know, whether or not we know the words, they allow us to again feel the pulse and embody what we will be speaking about. So welcome to Making the Gods Work for You. So what are the gods? You know, what are our terms here? You know, very strong mystery. So we'd say there are forces that reside within our psyche that we will call gods, but that connect us to very real external forces. And this is the reason this can give Jungians the willies, because it's not just cozy archetypes in our interior being, but actual real forces in the world that live in us. Again, there's no separation between spirit and matter, and there's no separation between us and the rest of the world. So as we begin to feed these forces within us, which we'll be delineating, we then also strengthen our capacity to summon these forces. It's very much the model to sort of transcend humanism, the idea that humans are the measure of all things. It says, no, humans need help. They need this alliance of spiritual resources larger than ourselves. There's nothing that we can resolve in our own personal lives or the collective life without help. So we say, you know, spiritual operators are standing by, and the way in which we place our call is through the music. And the other way is through what we think and how we direct our thoughts. And when I talk about visionary activism, the wedding of spiritual practice and the alliance of evolutionary forces with compassionate social action as the unbeatable force that can help us to dream, conjure, and implement a more lovingly ingenious world into being, I mean it in very specific ways that indigenous peoples know about directly. We know it too, but when we mention it, it reawakens our memory. So for instance, you know, when the Oneida Indians in Canada were unhappy that their ancestral burial grounds were about to be turned into a golf course, they gathered to protest this. And as the army mounted to remove them from blocking the bridge into Montreal, the Oneida summoned and invoked their wind god. So as the army lobbed tear gas at the Native Americans, the wind mysteriously shifted and it blew it back at the army, and then the Native Americans got in the tanks and chased the army away. Colleagues of mine on the Big Island of Hawaii, a lot of children as well who are Native Hawaiians who are deeply connected to their island, which they love, and to Pele, the goddess is the land. Again, this is pandemic in many cultures, but in Hawaii it is absolutely living for those people who love it. So when there was a very bad idea of a power plant being built in virgin forest, the Hawaiians gathered to invoke Pele and said, we offer ourselves to you, Pele, volcano goddess, that we may do your will and help to prevent this unsacred act. So every time the army engineers laid the foundation for this power plant, Pele, the volcano goddess, blew it up. And so the scientists, of course, said, this should not happen statistically. Let's do it again. So they'd build this thing, and then Pele would blow it up. And apparently three times they said, we'll go somewhere else. So again, the model also is this idea of the alliance in South Africa, where I met with Sangomas, traditional medicine people. It's the social action, but also wedded to the spirit forces. We know the Haitian Revolution started at a voodoo meeting. It's this sense of, again, tapping into what wants to happen and drawing upon forces of support larger than ourselves. There are many examples. It's one of those things that once we begin to be open to it, we see it everywhere. Newspaper story in Puerto Rico mentioned a woman. Puerto Rico has very, very deep ocean waters around it, And it is said in tradition that Yemaya, the ocean goddess, lives where it is deepest in the sea. So it is her stronghold. And the currents are very tricky. And a vacationing family from the Dominican Republic lost their son. He was swept out to sea and the body was not recoverable. And so the woman who was a devotee of Yemaya, in her great grief, there were search parties and they gave up. And she said, one more time. And so they humored her and they took the boat out and she said, stop here. And she sang her song to Yemaya and said, you are a mother, I am a mother. I know you cannot bring my son back to life, but give me back his body. The researchers, as reported in the newspaper, were amazed as the body surfaced from the depths at that moment. Now, these are not simple mysteries, nor simply joyful. You know, the son was not alive. But again, it says there are real forces of kinship that are great mysteries. And mystery is healthy for us to be, you know, engaged in those things which we don't fully grapple with or define or contain, but which we can offer ourselves to. As incarnational vessels, each one of us being able to give a unique expression, because we are at this crucial time in world history, which Jungians call a kairos moment or a fulcrum moment in history, which means that everything that everyone does matters enormously. Innumerable lives of communities and species hang in the balance, as we all know. The crucial model that we'll be invoking really is that we vote for reality with our imaginations, and we want to use dark likelihoods, not to make us passive, but as incentives to dream up something much larger. We know that the I Ching reminds us perpetually, but it seems to be increasingly fierce, and says, the task is great. It is nothing short of leading the world from disharmony and back to order. And we'd also say we're not working with a fixed future model. You know, the future is not fixed, but it's not broken either. So we do vote for a reality with our imaginations. And we'd also say this language wants to invite us to entertain possibilities, one of which is that each one of us, we are undercover agents, you know, each with a mission. The nature of this world and this life means we might fall asleep to it. But the subversive nature of this powerful language is that whatever we speak to, we wake it up. So first also, we'd say the forces of greed are lumbering slowly and steadily towards the abyss and carrying the net of creation with them. So it is incumbent upon us, the imaginative, to pull out our literal and invisible scissors and snip that net away from the forces of greed so that they can hurtle themselves into the abyss to be transformed in some later Buddhist universe. But meanwhile, the net of creation will be safe. So we'd say the forces of greed are lumbering and large and stupid, and the forces of imaginative quickening alive in all of us now, in which we intend to make more alive on out into the world, are sleeker and sprightlier and faster. So again, it is this kairos moment. This language, what I call visionary activist astrology, would define the task of being human as to discern the pattern of evolutionary intelligence, meaning the most lively possibilities available at any moment, and to offer oneself to that, to align with that. So it's really saying, whatever the most lively possibilities are, let me line up with that. The Mayan word for human means one who owes. It's a little grim, but it's still that sense of contributing a gift. And most of us know that the word therapy in its original meaning means healing, but if you go back one layer, the word therapy means to serve the gods. It's always this reciprocal, gift-giving, pulsing intimacy with creation, which we want to bring back. There are several visionary activist principles that are created from my own years of serious whimsy that will suffuse our gathering. Principle zero is believe nothing, entertain possibilities. Okay, now this is crucial. You know, when people say, you don't really believe in, you know, astrology or Buddhism or whatever, I mean, it's always wonderful to be able to say, no, I don't, you know. It's good to be able to do that. But I say, no, don't believe in astrology, but don't believe in science or right-wing government either. There's a wonderful colleague of mine, Stephen James, who says, there's absolutely no astrological evidence that science is anything more than a medieval superstition. So we sort of go, ha. A Tibetan saying says, knowledge is like gold. You can work it and beat it and hammer it. Only then can you wear it as an ornament. And somebody else's research gives one no juice unless one has really earned it. But we can entertain these possibilities. So the next principle, that's principle zero. Principle one is imagination lays the tracks for the reality train to follow. So our primary act of devotion is expanding imagination. And it means that when we're working with other people and also seeing other people work in any kind of delicate and or counseling way, What I say is to use languages and tools of liberation to in any way make someone passive or constrain their imagination is spiritual harassment. That kind of constraint or abuse is a kind of treason. So it's really about enlarging possibilities while paying attention to shadow amply, but stretching the fabric of the possible. So principle number two is better to create prophecy than to live prediction. Now, this is increasingly important for all of us as we become prophets in a sense and storytellers about how it's all connected and go out into the world at this crucial time to do that. The reason being, you know, things are in such radical flux that people crave a kind of certainty. We are all learning how to dance and embrace radical change as our ally, and indeed even industrial breakdown as an ally. You know, so we can engage as we go along also in what I call clean magic. Clean magic can be fierce, but it's anything that we would amply embrace for ourselves. We might say, let projects that are really up to no good in terms of the collective, may they run out of money for the good of the people who are also running them. Fierce, effective, and yet clean. So we anchor ourselves to those kinds of principles. It's also, again, the theme, you know, as we get to the 21st century and the end of the Mayan calendar, you know, 2012, it is, you know, all the inquiry, you know, for useful, true prophecies and crank theories and predictions. As we all go out into the world, we're presented with those. You know, I often do a lot of radio and people say, well, here's this prophecy, the Earth's axes are going to change and, you know, everyone except strict vegetarians will die. And, you know, and I go, well, do you like that vision? They go, no. And I say, well, don't vote for it, okay? We vote for reality with our imaginations. So it's not to vote for it. Again, we entertain it. We see if it's useful as an incentive to dream up something better. But it's also crucial to remember that, you know, great, you know, clairvoyant Edgar Cayce predicted that in the early 1970s, the East Coast of America would be deluged under a great flood. And what we had was Watergate. You know, we get to choose, again, the metaphorical level as increasingly active and playful shapers of the material universe, or agents of shaping, in a sense. So this is, I think, important also for all of us to hold our ballast. You know, a great ally of mine also used to say, doom and gloom predictions are really just for people with balloon payments due. And it's like, to hell with the whole thing, yeah. Okay. So principle three is the invisible world would like to help, but spiritual etiquette requires that we ask. That's often why we experience breakdown, in which even the most rational among us go, you know, oh, God's help, you know. And the gods go, thank God they asked, you know, now we can help. But a crucial segue that goes with that, principle four, is the only way the gods, these forces within and without, know we're asking for help is ritual. We are ritualistic beings. And again, you know, in a non-ritual culture. We're emotional in an emotionally illiterate culture, mythologically illiterate culture, you know, intuitively illiterate culture, all these things that we're redressing. But certainly also ritual. And for our basic purposes, we'll say ritual is anything that we do that's physical, it's the earliest form of theater, that is physical, that we imbue with intention. It doesn't have to be some elaborate, hokey, superstitious thing that someone told you to do, because that, again, would be a kind of booby prize. The ritual is not for superstition, it is for clarifying intention and to what one is offering oneself. So we can sweep out the floor, or we can sweep out the past as we sweep out the floor. So the only way the gods know we're asking for help is ritual. Also, principle five is if something's a problem, make it bigger. You know, part of the nature of the problem of the modern world is in our own personal psyches and in the larger world, this issue of suppressing and or editing. We want to kind of ollie-ollie income free these parts of ourselves. So it says, if you're irritated, get angry. If you're angry, get enraged. If you're enraged, get outraged. If you follow it the whole way through, it becomes very clean, and that art is crucial for that. That there are Congo dances I saw in Cuba where the dancers who were women, they used to be men but now they're women, would take the anger and frustration of the community and summon it up through the earth into their bodies where they would cook it and then change it and transform it into dynamic energy for the whole community. And again, this idea that whatever we ritualize, we need not literalize, but it's the idea also, if something's a problem, make it bigger. It's very much related to the only advice that Joseph Campbell would give, which is, if you find that you're falling, dive. And where he got this from was, James Joyce had a schizophrenic daughter whom he took to all the great healers in Europe, convinced that she was a genius, and they finally washed up on Jung's doorstep. And Jung said, no, actually, she's really nuts. The difference is, you're diving, she's falling. So again, if something's a problem, make it bigger. If you are falling, you know, point your toes. You know, principle six is we only possess the power of an insight when we give it expression. This really ties us also to ritual, too. There's a world of difference between being in therapy and going, fascinating insight about my father, and actually making an altar to one's insight, you know, or in some way physically expressing it. It does a lot more. Again, the gods then can come to live there. Because what we've also come to do is to heal the breach of the invisible, visible, and the material world, knowing again that they are one thing. And so spirit loves matter. You know, and again, when the simple act of setting up altars, they are like vessels. If we make something beautiful, then invisible magic comes to live there. The last principle also is principle 7, creativity comes from the wedding of paradox. We aspire to be disciplined wild people who are radical traditionalists, embracing what the reality police would view as contradictions. Either I can be practical or idealistic. And the gods say, are you kidding? They belong together. Idealism is completely practical. If our vision is just a little bit longer, then the rainforest is worth more, even in crude economic terms, as a rainforest, than as two seasons of bottom line Burger King. Now, one other symbol also, too, which is crucial to our construct here, is the cross is an image that long predates Christian symbolism. And it was always meant to show the two paths of the human world and the spirit world, you know, nourishing and flowing into each other. And the point at which the two lines intersect is the dance, you know, the choreography of creation that invites us to join in. So that's what we're extremely interested in, entertaining the possibility and invoking, that intersection. You know, the gods say, everything right now is designed so that we cannot do it alone. We cannot do it alone as solo humans, nor can we do it alone even as a community of humans without a sense of opening up to that which wants to happen. And again, everything is designed for us to experiment that way. So what does it mean, this uppity title, you know, making the gods work for you, you know? Well, the gods have a sense of humor. So they assured me that they didn't mind the title as this kind of playfully uppity, reverently irreverent title. And the invisible subtext is making the gods work for you, provided we work for them. And then we might say, what is the connection between the planets and the gods? You know, well, we'd say all cultures, you know, have projected their mythology to the sky. But it's larger than that, because the implications, again, are mysterious. It implies that the universe is indeed symbolic, that is its nature. It's one of the sort of amazing things that, for instance, Venus, associated with the planet Venus and the goddess of symmetry and beauty and harmony and aesthetics, the more that science learns, the more apt the assignation is. You know, scientists have recently learned that the planet Venus itself is the most perfectly round and symmetrical of all the planets in our solar system, and that her orbit, which if you track it, makes a five-petaled shape in the sky, if you track it in terms of eight-year cycles, it's the most perfectly symmetrical. Now, Uranus is the god of, you know, disruption, unorthodoxy, upheaval, tricksterness, that part of us that we welcome into the world that we need more and more and more. It's the unorthodox part of ourselves that contributes to culture through edge and disruption and making things honest and authentic. So scientists have recently discovered that Uranus is the one planet that, counter to all the other planets, it orbits counterclockwise. It's its own eccentric being. So we say, well, there's something here, you know. And again, astrology also invites us to a school and to a re-kinship with the world in order to be increasingly effective players on the team of creation. Either the world is indeed magical, in which that is clearly the only way to live, or it is not magical, in which indeed it is still the only way to live as though it were. Because otherwise, you know, there's no future in nihilism. We want to live the truth that we aspire and really yearn to be true. And then indeed we begin to find corollaries that yes it is, these coincidences. So, you know, we all know friends, what I call bitter basement bohemian bureaucrats, you know, suffering from alienated breakdown, and we like them, you know, but we go, you know, your beliefs are not really supporting you, this kind of existential Sartre, we clone, you know, no fun MBA approach to life. You know, why don't you try some other more fun experimental attitudes and see what happens? So that's really, again, what we're doing. So we're going to be introducing the 10 planetary gods, forces of our own psyche. And how do we work with these? What might it mean to feed them inside us? And then by doing that, we gain the spiritual muscle tone to feed these forces in the world. There's also shadow. What happens when we don't feed these parts of ourselves? And also what happens in a cultural sense when we don't feed this part of ourselves? So we'll be exploring, you know, how do we expand our range of intimacy with these God forces represented by the 10 planetary bodies other than the Earth, because this is where we are, which include the Sun and Moon. Now, we have a seven-day week. There are many more accurate calendars, but literally we have a seven-day week because of seven visible planetary bodies in the sky. That's how we live. And the original calendar impulse is not just to know when to go to your dentist appointment. It is to stake out time to revere that part of the psyche and that part of the world. And that's the calendrical impulse. So we have Sunday, you know, Moon Day. You can hear Tuesday, too, is the Norse Mars god, but you hear it in French, Mardi, Mars Day. You know, Wednesday, Woden's Day, is also Mercredi in French, Mercury's Day. Thursday, Thor's Day, like Jupiter. You know, and Friday, Freya, the Norse Venus, Freya's Day. And then, of course, Saturn Day. So these are wonderful things to work with, to go, oh, on Moon Day, we honor the moon, and we'll be exploring again what that might mean. So we are all practicing astrology, but we've forgotten that we are. So to stake out time, very simple rituals. What I love to do, and life works better when I do simple things, you know, is to always offer a gift to the world when you step out your doorway in the morning, and just whatever you treasure, tobacco, sage, you know, talcum powder, you know, whatever, just to blow it and say, open our, my paths before us and grant us the opportunity to be of maximum good in the world. You know, that kind of offering then guides the current. We often don't know exactly what to do, and in times when we don't know what to do, we simply offer ourselves to these larger forces in an attitude of experimental faith. It's not believing, it's not superstitious, it's not, ooh, if I don't do this, you know, the gods will be mad, you know. It's more that sense of clarified intention and dedication. So we first summon these gods by simply thinking about them. You know, already they're coming in the room, you know, and they're stirring in our psyches. So we're giving a vocabulary, and by having a vocabulary, we begin to activate these parts of ourselves more strongly. You know, and so considering, con, with, sitter, the stars, considering these forces helps us to gather our wits. And the model is that as we reclaim the capacity to hear ourselves think in these different voices, through music, through stories, through words, through rituals, we once more hear the reassuring voices of the gods thinking within us. And we say each of us has access to innumerable wise voices once we begin to cultivate and pay attention to them. You know, we all know the people who say, oh, I never remember my dreams. But if you put a piece of paper and a pen beside your bed, it's like the gods go, look, they're listening. Let's send them a really wild one. Again, ritual through creating altars. You know, the gods go, look, they're ready to receive this. Let's give them some good juice. You know, and it's also why when people come to complete moments of uncertainty and breakdown, the god parts of us, like that. They go, look, these humans have run out of plans. Finally, now we can work with them. You know? So it's a way of also, you know, being able to dance increasingly in a friendly way with forces of dramatic change and upheaval, to make it our allies, again, to become dancers in life, to have things dance through us. We know the nature of learning anything. A complicated dance step or a complicated mathematical technique. It's, say, with dance, you know, you're self-conscious and you're going one step, but then you get to a certain level of mastery and then you are danced and then you learn something more and it's self-conscious and then you are it. So it's this active pulse, it's concentration, offering of self as we learn and evolve. So the planetary guides, we have the innumerable wise voices that we will be sequentially bringing alive, beginning with Saturn. Saturn is the god of authority, form, structure, often gets a bad rap in culture. People who know a little or even a lot about astrology go, oh, Saturn. Saturn is sort of the ring pass not guide who will introduce us to the change gods, the outer planets beyond Saturn. Saturn's again the definer of the laws, and Pluto, Neptune, and Uranus represent forces in us, in the culture, in the world, that break those laws and allow us to transcend reality. But it's also useful, we need to learn the laws or the art form before we can begin to mess with it. You know, Picasso had to paint before he could unpaint. James Joyce had to be able to write before he could unwrite. So Saturn introduces us to the Pluto, Neptune, Uranus gods and says to relate to what they represent, death, rebirth, transformation, dissolution, and vision, and freedom often gained through loss, we need a Saturnine demeanor, a kind of serious, cool, you know, maintaining sense of humor attitude to deal with this heavy stuff. Jupiter, the jovial large god, Jupiter is our introduction to the inner planets, Mars, Venus, Mercury, the Moon, and the Sun. On in, we'll be wending our way on into the central pulse of our solar system. The outer planets move very slowly. Pluto takes a 250-year cycle to make a full circuit, you know, and it's the expensive wisdom initiatory god, so we don't dance with it that often in a strong way. Neptune, you know, takes 165 years to move around, Uranus every 84 years. So when we are born generationally, we're all going to have Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto pretty much in the same positions in the sky, and it describes a generation's assignment in a sense. As we move into the inner planets, Jupiter on in, we'd say that these planets are more customized, you know, for all of us. So it says the way we Mars, the way we make love, the way we do things energetically, unique to all of us. It's the heroic offering. You know, what we love, Venus, everybody's got a unique way of doing that, and that's why there are a lot of us, because we need a profusion of what these planets represent. Mercury, everyone's got a different intellectual way of learning and speaking, and we'd love our social system and our school system to understand that and to encourage and revere a wide variety of different ways of apprehending and learning. And the moon, we all have a different set of emotional response cycles. And the sun, we all have a unique individuality through which to offer ourselves to the gods. So, without further ado, take it away, ladies, into the rousing adventure that we're embarking on.
Your conscience, and we have returned. We have returned.
I now light for all of us something that Sangomas in South Africa gave to me to bring to us. It's called Mapehu, and it summons the ancestors, and we can expand our definition of ancestors. Somebody said, well, what if my ancestors were assholes? And I said, well, there is that problem. This is all ancestors of good character are invited. And it's also that really the expanding that sense of our teams and our allies now. And what that means is that when you open a book and you find somebody in history, you know, that is doing the work that you are carrying on, ancestor connection. Anyone that you have loved who has died is an ancestor, even if they are younger than you. You know, and so this idea of the invisible world really wants to help. And they want to help also as we bring on Saturn. Saturn is our ringmaster who introduces things. Saturn is the power of definition and how radical that is. So William Blake reminds us, I must create a system or be enslaved by another's. I will not reason and compare. My business is to create. People who know a little bit about astrological and also medieval terminology, you know, go, oh, Saturn, whoa, you know, Saturn return, bad, you know. And we go, no, that's a little more spiritual harassment. As a colleague of mine who loves Saturn says, Saturn, oh, uh-oh, might get something done. Whoa, no. Yeah. Saturn is the god of form, structure, and definition and authority. You know, and Saturn is very eager. It's a concept I want us all to entertain, that the gods are really tired of their old forms. So these forces are happy to grow new forms, and we will be giving Saturn a much cheerier form of expression. Saturn also says that's very cool. And part of what Saturn, the gift from the Yoruba people to us, is the word cool, as popularized by jazz musicians in the 1930s. It comes from Yoruba tradition that we are in part honoring also today, as much of our language and our hip jargon does indeed come from Nigeria. But cool means in Yoruba language, you'd say that a perfectly carved bead was cool, that an exquisite passage of drumming was cool, that someone who took care of stuff, you know, who was incredibly responsible, was cool. Cool meant doing it just right and being incredibly responsible, a self-possessed Saturn, responsible to oneself and responsible to the community. So Saturn would say, well, let's restore the original definition of what it is to be a cool guy. Now, Saturn does deal with, you know, solo, serious themes, but the crucial part of when people read astrology books or when they read psychology books, you know, Saturnine and so on, and it's about depression and fear, those are symptoms of not honoring this god correctly. So if Saturn is the god of authority, which contains the word author, and it says it is incumbent upon each of us to be the author of our lives, to inhale back our authority. And of course, authority is the thing we most tend to give away to our father, the state, the guru, the lover, the... And the idea is Saturn really lives in our ballast point. It is our crucial, you know, center. So we want to kind of inhale it back from the vast reaches of past disbursement where we've flung it, you know, and anybody who could make us feel bad, you know, oh, I hope I'm good, you know, approve or disapprove, that's where our Saturn is gone, and we want to really inhale it back in now would be good. So, you know, why wait? You know, and also any grouchy authority issues that you have going with your father, you know, why not just, you know, be resolved by the end of our gathering today? You know, form that intention. Now, again, the way we speak astrology is when we speak about someone has, you know, someone got my goat. Well, goat is one of the astrological symbols for Saturn and Capricorn, that is Saturn's sign. So when you say somebody got your goat, they got your authority. They really got you, you know. So we want our goat back, too. It's now, to give us an example of how often we give our goat away, you know, a friend observed the following strange, you know, street life scene in New York in which there was a kind of homeless, crazy person on the subway, not harmful, but he was going around to a group of people just waiting, you know, and trying to sort of ignore him. And he would go up to each person and go, you, you're out. And he'd go to another person and go, you, you're in. You're out. You're out. You're in. And it was very clear that everyone was really hoping that they'd be in, you know. So it's like, well, if like we give away our authority to the random crazy person, you know, how much easier is it to give it away to government structures? And it's important that we get our word idiot. It comes from the Greek word idiotis, which meant someone who blindly abdicates their personal happiness to the public domain. That's the definition of being an idiot. Yeah, it's a good one. So Saturn also is the casting director. It's the god force, or, you know, the person who defines things, how it is, how the world works. And we tend to receive that. So Saturn is the casting director part of us that receives the conditioned script. Now, and so, in a sense, when Saturn is not conscious, Saturn is our inner idiot. So I say, to hell with the inner child. The inner idiot is really what we want to think about, in a sense, right now. Because the inner idiot, you know, hires unsuitable lovers, incompetent policemen, abusive bosses, and other guaranteed failures. So the inner idiot is really the one who inherits the conditioned script. Now, the model is if we can rewrite our script. You know, let's give an example, for instance. You know, say somebody, you know, I'm sure all of us here had entirely supportive, jolly fathers. But for those few people not here who didn't, it can look something like this, which is that, say, Saturn and Mars, an antagonistic, you know, or square relationship to each other, would be a script where the father's worldview, not necessarily spoken, says life is hard, it's a struggle, you know, duty and desire are in conflict, there's no free lunch, you know, and you can't do what you want or you'll be poor. So we inherit that script, and it might be also for, say, a woman in relationships, in that just one domain, that the unconscious casting director would say, I am casting in my life for energetically depressed, you know, men who are not living their dream, and yet who tell me that all of my original interesting impulses are impossible and silly. In the realm of work, you know, guys and women might say, we are casting, a casting call, you know, for our movie, for abusive, competitive authority figures, bosses, you know, who are threatened by original ideas. You know, but at a certain stage of had it, you know, that's the technical term, had it, one says, no, no, I used to be complicit in invoking this pattern, but now I'm rewriting the script. Now, the crucial part is that when we do this for ourselves, we basically build up the spiritual muscle tone to participate in rewriting the culture script in a larger sense out there in the world. So this rewriting of the script is really crucial, and part of what Saturn would like to give us is two crucial phrases, which is whenever we state something that is not, you know, a reality that we would like, oh man, I'm really tired, and or this person always gets my goat, Saturn says, the positive Saturn, the nurturing, self-possessed Saturn says, until now, but now, you know, such and such. Now, I mean, this is really important, and it's very interesting how resistant, you know, we can all be at some point, and this is why we have friends to help us. You know, people go, oh, yada, yada, yada. You know, I'm overwhelmed by all the emotional responsibilities, you know, that I have, you know, yada, yada, until now. You know, and the second phrase that Saturn would give us is, that goes with until now, I used to, ... be overwhelmed by emotional responsibilities and annoyed at the idiocy of people. But now, you know, I attract sufficient grace and support from the gods that my previous burdens are, you know, have become sources of joy. You know, I mean, whatever. We don't have to say it with a straight face. It's just, again, entertaining the possibility. You know, I'm turning it around. And again, Saturn says the truth of what we worship is what we focus on and what we spend our time on. It's not what we say we worship. It's why a friend of mine says she never clips coupons, because it's a trick to worship industrialism. You know, it sort of eats all your time thinking about that. No, never mind. So it's really that question of the art form of intention is really crucial. It's also important to talk back to the reality police, because the inner idiot, you know, the conditioned inner idiot, is that voice inside us also, that when we have a good idea, it says, yeah, how? You know, you can't do that, you don't have any money, you know, you're not cute anymore, you're getting old, you know. And so it's important to be able to turn on that and go, you, negative Saturn, go file some things in the office, you know. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, get out of creative reverie, you know, and we'll tell you when you can come back. Now, you know, and of course, Saturn says that periodically, you know, when we talk about Saturn returns or Saturn transits, we do have important appointments with this God part of ourselves. You know, it is time to pull in, pull back, you know, from the collective drama and to clarify, you know, what form really suits one. And again, the only in recent memory difficult reading I had was a man who came in and he said, you know, I got a great car, I got a great wife, I got a great house, I'm happy, right? And it was poignant because it's like, right, I am, right? You know, I mean, it's like, well, is that your definition of happiness? He was like, you know, and so again, this idea of withdrawing our complicity, you know, from, you know, to defining things for ourselves, what is meaningful work, what is wealth, what is a good relationship, we inhale back our authority and redefine it. And these are very radical acts. To define the terms of engagement is crucial. So Saturn also says that if we don't willingly follow our own intuitions to go in with this appointment with ourselves, because we're in this kind of hyper-yang social culture, then Saturn will reach up and pull us down, which we often experience as depression. But instead, it's a reminder not to live life by default. You know, not to go along with other people's definitions of what's useful or important. So Saturn traditionally has been called the dweller on the threshold, or the ring pass knot. And it does refer to the scary initiatory ordeal that each of us must undergo when we encounter all that is blocking us, all that keeps us fearfully obedient to a life of oppressive limitation, which we'd say is any life that is not our own, even if it looks cute. So the catalyst also is, you know, we have breakdowns. It's also in working with Saturn, we learn, we observe nature, and everything is real and everything is symbolic. So a friend of mine taught me about the Potomac River near which I live, and he said there are these currents called keeper currents, and they go from the top surface of the river down to the bottom and then up again. And if you fall into one, and you do the natural thing, which is to fight it back to the surface, it will drown you. And so what you have to do actually is go all the way down to the bottom and come up the other side, which takes some faith. And that's, again, part of the Saturn process. If you find that you're falling, dive. You have to go all the way down to the bottom, to the appointment with some deep part of ourselves, and back up to the top. But that's why we have this language, it's why we have friends, it's why we have literature, it's why we have mythology, because these are tools and guides that go, oh, you're not quite touching bottom, but entertain the possibility that if you keep going, you will. But if you fight this thing, you'll feel like you're drowning. You know, so also the catalyst often is the breaking of a rule. Saturn sets rules, but often in order to find one's own rules, you have to break a rule. It's like also rhythm. Sometimes to find out what your own natural rhythm is, you have to walk in a way that is not, and then you know how you walk. So it reminds us that the word sacred comes from the word sakir in Greek, which meant if you left the community, the communities in Greece, there would be signs outside that said, if you go beyond this sign, you are sakir. You are on your own without the protection of the human community. You are in the wild, howling, you know, God-force wilderness. So sacred means a solo act of defiance in which one must go alone and leave behind the support of the more orthodox community. So solitude is one of Saturn's sacraments. And no wonder, again, this god is so misunderstood in the modern world. You know, oh, fear and depression. That's really what we're calling solitude. And Saturn says that solitude is the portal to the magical realm where power larger than us resides. And Jung said, you know, you must be alone to find out what supports you when you can no longer support yourself. For only in this way will one build an indestructible foundation. There's a Washington poet who says, solitude is the cure for loneliness. Partying won't cure loneliness. Like cures like. Again, if something's a problem, make it bigger. If you're lonely, get really alone into solitude where you pop out into a sense of connectedness to everything. Solitude allows us to consider our lives and to align the inner gods with the outer gods of the cosmos, you know, to disentangle ourselves from the phantasmagoria of seductive distractions. And another way also we can think about Saturn comes from a story in which sociologists took video clips of people walking down the street. And they took these clips into prisons and showed them to prisoners and said, who would you mug? And they said, anyone who was arrhythmic, we would mug them. You know, and Saturn, our ballast, says, you know, we all know that we can become metaphorically mugged in a conversation as well as literally on the street. The resolution of that is about finding one's own pulse and one's own rhythm, which is why Saturn, again, likes us to enjoy solitude, where we go, even for a moment, even for the hour, when would I get up? What do I feel like doing? When would I go to sleep? What would I eat? What is my rhythm? Again, the example also of the rhythmic walk. In Gurdjieff schools, people were instructed to walk differently or walk funny on purpose so that then you could know what your walk was like, your own rhythm or your own pulse. Leading edge great medicine healing work now, you know, sacrocranial work and body work, is all about the restoring of the original pulse to the person. You know, and again, this is Saturn work. You know, this is when people go, oh, Saturn transit, might have to get a lot of body work. Yay, you might get things done. Saturn work is, again, restoring authority, might get a lot written. So Saturn would like to leave us with several images. One, just for all of us to imagine inhaling again authority, just, you know, inhaling it from the past, you know, vast expanses of disbursement. And just inhaling it and just exhaling as a, you know, that's something to take with us out whenever we feel frightened to go, wait, let me just pull my Saturn back in and my ballast, my rhythm. You know, the ballast and rhythm part also is interesting too, because the word hysteria, you know, was derived from the Latin word for uterus. It was thought that women, you know, were more hysterical. Really, the nature of hysteria, as defined by a Jungian analyst friend of mine, is It's a healthy response. It's like the fish on the hook thrashing. It's a response to finding oneself in a world not of one's own definition. You know, and going, whoa, help, you know, let me out of this. This is not my world. We might say that that was more available to women, but in the modern world, we'd say thrashing crazily or hysteria is maybe the predominant dance step now and widely available equally to men and women, you know, who find themselves in a world not of their own creation. And Saturn again says, inhale back in. A corollary also is that sense of we don't want someone else's Saturn either. Went to a wonderful masseuse once who said, oh, there are, you know, all these people kind of hooked into your solar plexus. Let's imagine taking a golden knife and cutting these connections and cutting the cords of connectedness at the other end and seeing those people standing strong and radiant on their own. It's a very nice image because it's not, ooh, yucky vampires, yeah, you know, which tends to, you know, make yucky vampires, of course, cling more. It's more that idea of, like, cut the connection, Saturn self-possessed, and see those people also with their own Saturn, just strong on their own two feet. So that's also something in our mind's eye, you know, you can now just imagine cutting cords of dependency because we do not want to be complicit in the dependency of others either. And then cutting the cord at the other end, just snip, snip, and seeing anybody that you feel is dependent upon you as standing strong on their own. Now, Qigong also provides us the coordinate of center. You know, people talk about centering, but even seated, you can find kind of geographic physical coordinates. Imagine a vertical line from the base of your spine, you know, even seated, to the crown of your head. And then imagine a horizontal line from the small of your back to just below your navel. And where those lines intersect, put your attention, and that center. It's the spirit cross again. And Saturn says, in that place, when your mind is there, there is no fear, and you're in touch with your original pulse. And if we're in touch with our original pulse, then we're in touch also with our unique contribution to the world. Saturn's the part of our psyche that keeps the beat. You know, it plays bass in the band, several layers beneath the busyness of the world. So to honor Saturn and to also allow this god with a bad reputation, a much more playful way of being, we're going to invoke Ogun in a moment. And Ogun in the Santeria tradition is the setter of limits. He is the rhythm keeper. But he's also a kind of Saturn figure in the positive side of Saturn that we don't often remember. Ogun is a woodsman. He loves nature, art, and beauty. And it reminds us again in English of the word husbandry. Husbandry harkens back to just, again, a pre-industrial culture not very long ago where it was understood that men were tremendously nurturing. Husbandry was the art of raising and kinship with plants, animals, babies, creatures, on out. And that's very available to us. So part of us also as the radical act of defining is certainly also to stretch back the narrow claustrophobic walls of fear, dread, and also small definitions. And that certainly also involves gender. You know, just spreading it back way, way back in terms of what, you know, what it is to be a guy and what it is to be a woman in the modern world and going much further, reaching back for more amplitude. So Ogun will help us. Take it. Back in a jollier form. Do people feel self-possessed, possibly? You're willing to entertain the possibility that you're more self-possessed? So Saturn sets the rules and says, well, now we head on out to the change gods, to Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. They teach us how to further transcend the conditioned scripts. These are forces, parts of us, that we will now bring quite alive. These gods live in the upper zones of cooperation, where we are each agents of principles rather than subject to laws. So the change gods, of course, will do whatever it takes to liberate us from the constraints of conditioning. So very often, it can be a bumpy ride. You know, the change gods, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, really want to strip us of certainty. And so it's about learning how to, in a world that likes us to have a snappy identity, how do we become comfortable when there are moments where we lose our sense of certainty? And also what they would like to introduce and sort of lay on the table before we take each one of them separately is a crucial theme of toxic mimic. Again, we take a real thing and extrapolate a metaphor from it. If we are deficient in iodine, we will absorb radioactive iodine. And similarly, if we are deficient in what the outer planets represent, we will absorb the toxic mimic. So for instance, with Neptune, Neptune is the god of dreams, vision, imagination, and mythos. It says, if we don't, as a culture, have a mythology, we'll have the toxic mimic of a celebrity culture. One makes us active, the other makes us passive. You know, again, you can see that with the tremendous outpouring around Princess Di, you know, born in Cancer, sort of a moon goddess, you know, a poignant and foibled human being, but she's the mother of the solstice king. Her son was born on the summer solstice. She dies on a solar eclipse underneath the Place d'Almes, which means the place of souls, and so on. And so there's this outpouring as though she were a moon goddess because we are not honoring or reverencing that part of our psyche, and this tremendous. So again, being able to read the world symbolically, go, ah, that's why, okay, is crucial, again, as we become increasingly effective social change artists. And the touchstone is what makes us active, what makes us passive. Mythology invites us to participate. Celebrity invites us to be passive consumers. And it's certainly also part of this language, at the very least, you know, allows us to put certain things on the table that on top of that we can begin discussion. I mean, one discussion also would be, you know, the needs of democracy. You know, we need what the outer change gods represent. Democracy requires alert, active, imaginative, participant players. Consumerism requires narcotized, asleep, obedient consumers. So it's like, there's a discrepancy here, which we want to begin to talk about. So Neptune says to be full of Neptune imagination, or we'll absorb the toxic mimic. Pluto is this god of death, rebirth, intensity. It's the part of us that really feels we have a mission. And Pluto also would say, you know, the forces of greed have kidnapped all the really sexy, fun stuff, and we want to kidnap it back, like intrigue and conspiracy. We want positive intrigues and positive conspiracies. There's a wonderful 19th century utopian named Fourier who said, in any ideal community, we must allow for the passion for intrigue. Because when we conspire to pull something off, you know, we draw upon much more elegant parts of our psyche than under fluorescent lighting. These nighttime, passionate parts, which haven't been invited to the mainstream party until now, okay, and that's what we're doing. So Pluto says the passion for positive intrigue, and if not, then we're kidnapped by faux Pluto's petty and often dangerous intrigues. Now, without a mission, we risk being drawn to street action or some white-collar variant. You know, without a community, we risk being drawn to gangs. Without a spiritual community, we risk being drawn to cults. So again, it's the toxic mimic. Uranus, also the trickster god, says, you know, we want to be the trickster or we're caught in the web of rebelling against. You know, if we're not full of our own original intuitive passion, you know, then we're caught in the web of rebelling against. Because Uranus says to rebel against something, of course, is to be just as much in its thrall as to conform. I mean, I'm sure all of us rebels and mavericks, you know, here can relate to that. Probably in examples, but you know, when I was little, you know, parents said, "Oh, you're going to be an astrologer. The only hope for you is to marry a rich man." I was like, "I will not. I'm going to marry the poorest man I can find." You know, and it's like that really showed them. So large and small challenges. So again, the millennial world, you know, where we are now, is described in many ways, and certainly is an invitation for us to become intimate, as we're about to do, with these change gods. So Chokash is a Native American storyteller who says, "The elders have sent me to tell you that now is like a great rushing river, and this will be experienced in many different ways. There are those who will try and hold on to the shore. There is no shore. It's crumbling." So she says, push off into the middle of the river, keep your head above water, see who else is in the river, and celebrate. The river knows where it's going. So we'd say, you know, and the pace of that kind of quickening is only picking up. So we want to dive in with Pluto. Pluto is the god of death and rebirth and renewal, and we draw it as a circle in the crucible. It is where we get cooked. You know, and so I was describing to a friend of mine, actually a client, you know, what Pluto was like. And she was going through Pluto transits, and really the description saying, Pluto's a ruthless Zen master, part of ourselves, that says, what do you think you need for a secure sense of identity? Let's see if you really need that. Let's take it away. Phoom! So it's like being in a room, ceiling goes, walls go, floor goes, and it's like free fall. So that's part of Pluto's descent. So she was like, ooh, just like the chickpea. And I said, I don't know this chickpea. And so she sent me the poem, which is a wonderful Rumi poem, translated by Coleman Barks. A chickpea leaps almost over the rim of the pot where it's being boiled. Why are you doing this to me? The cook knocks him down with the ladle. Don't you try jumping out. You think I'm torturing you, but I'm giving you flavor so you can mix with spices and rice and be the lovely vitality of a human being. Remember when you drank rain in the garden? That was for this. Grace first, sexual pleasure, then a boiling new life begins, and the friend has something good to eat. Eventually, the chickpea will say to the cook, boil me some more. Hit me with a skimming spoon. I can't do this by myself. I'm like an elephant that dreams of gardens back in Hindustan and doesn't pay attention to his driver. You're my cook, my driver, my way into existence. I love your cooking. The cook says, I was once like you, fresh from the ground. Then I boiled in time and boiled in the body, two fierce boilings. My animal soul grew powerful. I controlled it with practices and boiled some more and boiled once beyond that and then became your teacher. So we say, well, when we're dancing with Pluto, Pluto knocks us back into the pot and says, you know, are we comfortable with uncertainty? There's an initiatory descent, boom. And a friend of mine also says that, you know, dealing with Pluto is like a ramjet. I mean, you'll know if it's strong in your life and that we always want to be able to honor this god. A ramjet is one of the first prototypes of a jet engine and it gathers force from what it expels. So Pluto transits are about being freed up. You know, we run into trouble in initiatory descents when Pluto says, let me free you and strip you of everything that is in your way. But we tend to have a tug of war. You know, what the Pluto part of us thinks is essential and what we think is essential are often, you know, different. You know, but I like that identity or that house or that whatever. It's like, no. A client also who I'd been talking to about Pluto transits said he was really trying to put it to use and help Pluto's work by editing his closet also, too. This is me, this is not me, this isn't me, this is not me. When he got a call from a family friend saying there was a funeral that he must go to, so he left his closet editing, but he decided that he would drop the remaining clothes off at the dry cleaners, and he listed it was like, you know, 23 shirts and two sweaters and a blazer and all of his winter clothing, and went to the funeral in the midst of his Pluto transits. And on his way back from the funeral, he drove by the dry cleaners and noticed that it had burned down. So Pluto had evidently not thought that his editing was sufficient and had taken him to the dry cleaners. So Pluto basically says there's no safety in the fiction of a fixed identity. We'd say that modern culture is like, you know, musical chairs. And the shadow of modern culture is you're born into a role, you have an identity, you know, in a class society, and just stay there. But this idea of musical chairs now, as things are much more uncertain, you know, is the music plays and one chair is taken away. And we can respond in a number of ways. I mean, that's really the model of adopting a wide variety of emotional response to situations of flux. One could say, chair's gone. No, hey, I never wanted to play this game anyway. I'm leaving. And head on out. So it's a crucial thing to play. How much is one willing to release and let go of? And to step out into the unknown and to embrace and say, well, evolution is high stress. And so we strip ourselves of fiction of identity. The reason is also we have, you know, myths and guides and astrological language that will guide us in this. And part of also is to remember that in the ancient world, anyone who was anyone did an initiatory descent. So we know certainly the myth of Inanna. She's the Sumerian queen of heaven, who is also very frisky and feisty. She steals the tablets of heaven from her father and gives them to humanity. She basically says to humanity, take two tablets and call me after the millennium. No, so she descends. Pluto likes a sense of humor. Okay, anyway, so the tale is told of Inanna. It's ambiguous. Some say because of her own dauntless, intrepid curiosity, she arranges to go down to the underworld. And at each one of the seven like a chakra, gates to the underworld, she is stripped of her crown, her identity, her clothes, her job, you know, her boyfriend, her everything but her sense of humor. And then she meets Eriskigal, queen of the underworld, and Inanna is hung on a meat hook. But before she descended, she arranged with her friends and said, you know, if I don't come back in 60 days, this sort of Venusian descent, then please negotiate my release. So 60 days pass, and her father is concerned, and her friends are concerned, and they descend to broker a release, and a deal is cut whereby Inanna can return to the overworld as long as she sends down a replacement. Now, while she was gone, everyone was in mourning except for Dumuzi, who was her vegetative god husband, who was really partying it up. And we'd say, you know, Dumuzi, the vegetable god, had become a veritable, you know, vegetable potato. So as Inanna comes back up, she says, here's the deal, and who will I send back down? Everybody was mourning for me except for you. Okay, it's your turn to go down. So there's often in the underworld this sense of reciprocity. You know, you come back up, you send somebody down, girls come up, say, okay, boys, your turn down. So it is a flux of reciprocity. You know, in a similar tale from the Greek mythology, Persephone descends to the Plutonian underworld, a young girl, but ascends a queen and a woman. It's also useful not only to look up words, but to look up mythologies and to go back to their original source. Because the most well-known version of Persephone has her, you know, kidnapped by Pluto and descending. But this is a much later creation. In the previous tale, her descent is catalyzed not by a criminal act of kidnapping by a male god, but by a conscious decision to unite with her potent underworld self. In even earlier versions of the myth, Persephone is known as Proserpina, which means the first serpent, queen of the underworld, and she's the snake goddess, and one of her original names is Pluto. Like in dreams, we're not only all the parts of the dream, in myths we are also all of the players. And another crucial part of this is after Persephone's initial descent, her mother, of course, is in tremendous grief at losing her daughter and disguises herself as a wet nurse and is taken in by a mortal family. And each night, Demeter takes the mortal baby entrusted to her care and dips him into the fire. Whereupon one night, the mortal mother discovers this and says, oh my God, you know, and Demeter reveals herself as the goddess and says, you silly woman, you know, one more session and your child would be immortal. So we'd also say, well, you know, where are we one session short of doing something that looks irrational to the mainstream world, but that is really crucial? So anyway, Demeter, you know, reveals herself as the goddess and leaves in a huff. And then she goes off to Eleusis to found the Eleusinian Mysteries, which is the longest theatrical show in history. It ran for 400 years, and everyone was invited to participate. And it was slaves, children, men, women, I mean, everybody. The only people who could not participate were those who had committed murder. But again, this longest thing. And so Persephone and Pluto also say to all of us right now, we live in a culture that doesn't know a great deal about initiatory descent. And theater wants to come back up in this way, the art form of grieving that we'll move to in a moment also as well. How do we survive grief? And Pluto has a lot to tell us about this. But it is that theme. There's a wonderful book. The title is almost as good as the book. It's called The Death and Resurrection Show. And it's about the history of all theater as intrinsically transformative and initiative, as intrinsically carrying on from Eleusis. And it meant that what we crave now, again, we have the toxic mimic, you know, of loud. We know we're meant to get something from theater, but we often have not had that. You know, and we know from rock and roll shows, the lights and stuff, that something extraordinary and transformative is about to happen, but it doesn't. And again, the kind of response is, well, that didn't work, so let's crank up the volume or make it louder or brighter or something, which doesn't work. So we'd say that the nature of now also for all of us in this whole millennial time period is that everything wants to go on a vision quest to find its deeper, more mythological self. That theater wants to go on a vision quest to remember what it was for. Now, Pluto's all about power. The definition of power wants to go to the underworld and to redefine itself so that it's not power over, it's not the dominator virus, it's the power to transform which comes through us. Again, another Qigong exhortation reminds us, it says, relax, the qi is unlimited. You know, that there's enough coming all the time. Now, Pluto is that sense of power coming through us if we have that attitude of willingness.